This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 5 years after an infestation of little fire ant was first discovered in Nahiku, the Maui Invasive Species Committee is moving to take the drastic step of treating by air. Officials tell us the stinging ant was first found on a residential property in the remote Hana area, but then spread via a nearby stream. We talked to Lisa Strohecker, education specialist and ant program coordinator, Brooke Mankin, about what's in store.
I would call it aerial squirting, really, because spraying sounds scary. But we're delivering a bait that's of a pancake batter-like consistency. And so it squirts out, and we just need to get that all over about 150 acres in Nahiku, which is a densely vegetated jungle on the wet side of Maui. And so what that entails is a helicopter going up with tanks full of this gel bait and a big line that dangles down off of it. It's going to squirt out this bait, and we're going to fly back and forth like a pattern, like crop dusting, essentially. And that's going to be dependent on the weather and the wind, what direction the wind is coming from, because the helicopter is going to be flying at about 10 miles per hour ground speed. So the wind is going to play a big role in it.
So when do you plan on doing this exactly?
We have scheduled October 1st and 2nd. Again, the weather is a major issue. If it's rainy, we can't do this because it washes the bait away. So we have to make sure it's a good weather window, and it's the rainy side of Maui. So it's going to be... If it doesn't work on the first day we have scheduled, we've got a second day contingency plan. And if that doesn't work, we're going to have to make a new schedule with the helicopter.
What type of pesticide are we using exactly?
So the active ingredient is metoprene. And it's an insect growth regulator. So it isn't actually toxic to the little fire ants, but it will prevent them from reproducing. So it's like a birth control, and if we continue to feed the queens this birth control, eventually all the ants will die of old age. The problem with this infestation is we can't actually go on the ground and survey for the ants in all of the areas that we need to treat. The vegetation is so thick. There's how bush in acres and acres of the infested area. And so we need to be able to treat it for a long time until we don't find any ants anywhere around the infested area. And so typically we do 1 year of treatment, and we're going to do 8 treatments in 1 year. We'll assess the situation by doing what surveys we can do at the end of that year, but it's likely that we'll need to continue treating for 2 to 3 years.
What's the acreage that we're dealing with?
The acreage, although it might slightly change depending on new information coming in, we are aiming to treat 150 acres with each treatment.
So do we have to get special permits?
Yes. So we had to get a special local needs permit to be able to use the pesticide that we're using, brand name Altacid, in this area and in this application, because we are not using it as it is labeled. So we had to get a special permit to be able to use it in this manner. And that was the work done by the Hawaii Ant Lab.
And is this something that's safe to use in streams?
That's precisely why we had to get that label, because we can't use... we're restricted quite a bit to what we can use, because when we're flying and delivering this from the air, our bait is going to land in one of the streams or a couple of streams in the area. So what we're using is the insect growth regulator instead of a toxic bait, because the insect growth regulator, as I said earlier, not even toxic to the ants themselves, it's the least impactful pesticide that we could use in the area. So it's going to be, it will target the ants because they're attracted to the bait. And other things won't be affected much at all by it.
Okay, and that was going to be my next question, is what else will it affect?
So it'll affect anything that is attracted to the bait, goes to it, and ingests it. It's not really going to have much effect in the formulation that it's in if it drips or lands on something else. And so other insects are going to be affected by it, and it can affect some of the crustaceans in the streams and some of the fish, but probably won't, because we're mixing it with vegetable oil and beef liver powder, water, xanthan gum. It's 99% food, and this will probably float on the streams and won't dissipate into the water supply. Also, we're applying it in a low percentage format. In some places, this same product is used for mosquito mitigation, like Florida, for example. They actually put it into water supplies that eventually are for human consumption, but it prevents the mosquitoes from reproducing. So it's tailored to have the least impact possible.
Will this impact any of our birds?
It shouldn't have an impact on any birds.
Just to add a little bit to what Brooke is saying, I think we're really lucky to have such a safe method for treating. I mean, it's something, you know, like Brooke was saying, that, you know, it could affect insects, but those insects would have to be attracted to the bait. So, you know, even something like honeybees are interested in, you know, the protein powder or the bait mixture that we're using. So, you know, really the only way they'd be affected is if, like, a drop of this pancake batter hit them accidentally. So it's really, you know, we're really lucky. I don't think that's one of the benefits of this particular product that we're going to be using.
Are there any other types of, I don't know, wildlife or insects that there's been concern about?
There was a native endangered damselfly that had been reported in the general vicinity, and so the Fish and Wildlife Service came out and did a survey of the area to look for that damselfly, and they didn't find any evidence of that damselfly, but they did find that the streams in the area all have mosquito fish, which is a non-native introduced fish, and I was told that it's almost exclusive that if you find the mosquito fish, you will not find the native damselfly, which is evolved in the absence of predatory fish. And so when the fish is present, you don't find the native damselfly. There are other damselflies in the area. Those are introduced, non-native, and so they can subsist with the presence of the fish.
So I think that the Hana community has been extremely concerned about the presence of a large infestation of little fire ants, you know, right in their backyard. And from the get-go, they've been, you know, wondering, like, okay, what are you doing to keep it from spreading? What are you doing to keep it from spreading? So initially with this infestation, we did treat around the area where people are present to prevent any accidental vectoring. And it's been quite a process to get both, you know, the permits as well as build the actual sprayer and, you know, get the all that together. So we've had a series of community meetings to inform the community just where we're at in this process and, you know, how they can help. And they've actually been really helpful in getting the permits approved, you know, calling and having their local elected officials express the need for this to our agriculture, Department of Agriculture. And so we're looking at having one more meeting in the area. We're posting flyers explaining what's happening. We have a treatment schedule. We're sharing that with the community so that they know exactly what's going on. Like Brooke was saying, it's not going to be just one time and we're done. So it's a process. And for it to be effective, we need to complete the full process. And the people in Nihiku are, you know, they're basically extremely supportive. We're lucky that they're, you know, saying, okay, like, we don't want to have this little fire ant present here anymore. We know about the risk.
Do we know how the ants got there?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's, you know, when we found it, it was a large infestation, so it's almost impossible to trace it back.
It originated at a home, so it was definitely people that brought it.
This is the first time we're doing this spraying. Why didn't we do the spraying on the Big Island?
Maui has benefited from the Big Island in that we learned a lot, the Big Island, at their expense. The infestation there got away and out of control and was likely out of control by the time it was even discovered. On Maui, we have a chance to totally wipe out the ants. If we can tackle this infestation, all the other infestations here are under control. We could get rid of ants altogether on Maui.
So you're pretty confident, I mean, even though it's on 150 acres?
Yeah, I believe that this will work.
The folks from the ant lab, the Hawaii Ant Lab, Kaz, was saying that he worked it out per acre, and it was like 80 million ants per acre. I mean, that sounds like an awful lot of ants. So if you've got 150 acres, it's like a super colony.
Sure. When you put it that way, it sounds like a daunting task. But you have to remember that ants are a social species. So what they do is they go out and they find that bait and they bring it back and they share it with everybody and they feed it to the queen. And once that queen stops producing young, those ants will all die out from old age eventually and they're gone. So you only need to get the bait out in, you know, one droplet per square foot. Those ants will find it, seek it out, they'll go to it. So you don't have to, like, get every single ant. You just have to get it out there, and they'll go do the work for you.
I see. Okay. So that's what you've got working in your favor, then?
Definitely.
Okay. Anything else just about the challenges of the terrain, cost?
You know, I will say it might be interesting that there are systems already developed for controlling ants from helicopters, but they are large hoppers that carry granules that are dropped on areas, and we couldn't use those granules in this situation because of the stream. And we also needed our bait, because little fire ants are arboreal and they live on the ground and all the way up to the tops of trees, our bait has to be able to stick in the tops of the trees and land on the ground. So that's what Hawaii Ant Lab developed, this gel bait. But there is no system that exists for dispensing the gel bait from a helicopter. And so we had to come up with our own system. We have experience with other invasive plants, but those are using liquids. And so it was an interesting, difficult process to figure out how to build a system to push this weird slurry, this gel bait pancake batter out of our sprayer, and with enough force to be able to cover a large enough area that we don't have to fly a really tight pattern all day long, just dribbling out a little bit of our bait.
Okay, so you really had to be innovative.
Yeah, we've got some really good, handy people here that we just kept testing it and building it and tweaking it until we got something that worked.
Okay, so it's basically the Maui Invasive Species Committee. Who else? Ag? Department of Ag, maybe? That's helping?
With the development, it's been Hawaii Ant Lab and Maui Invasive Species Committee. We have a lot of collaboration from the Department of Ag here as well on the Little Fire Ant Project. We have been treating the areas where people are to prevent the people from moving the ants. The ants themselves, the infestation does grow, but very slowly over time.
It was this, you said it was found at a house, a residential, is it, because that's, if we're talking like Road to Hana, right? I mean,
yes,
kind
and
of remote.
So this area in Nahiku is, I mean, it's sparsely populated. There are homes here and there. They're large lots. And there's a lot of jungle in between.
It's just important for people to pay attention and report little fire ants early before it's 150 acres. You know, it's much easier to get rid of a 4-acre or even a 12-acre infestation. The techniques that we're using are pretty effective when we can get the population small. So,
yeah.
You know, Nahiku is kind of our last big challenge to get a handle on Maui.
I will add one thing that might be of interest to you is that the reason this infestation is so large is because a stream washed it from a sited elevation all the way down to the ocean. So that's why it spread so much and grew to the size that it is.
Gotcha. It had a highway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It had a highway.
That was Brooke Mankin and Lissa Stroker of the Maui Invasive Species Committee talking about the massive infestation of the little fire ant in Nahiku and the aerial treatment that is set to begin in October. For links, for more information, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In our backyard quiz today, we gaze out over the spectacular north-facing cliffs of Molokai, averaging over 2,000 feet high. Just about in the center of the island, as you look down from this pali, you see the very isolated Kalaupapa Peninsula spreading out beneath you, a broad, rounded triangle covering about 6 square miles. It consisted of 4 populated aupua in ancient days, but after 1865, Kamehameha V authorized an act forcibly isolating sufferers of Hansen's disease, known at that time as maipake, or leprosy, to the peninsula. Kalaupapa then gained its infamous reputation as the place where lepers were sent to die. The redeeming compassion of Father Damien's ministry for those afflicted with the disease changed the perception of this place from a living hell on earth to a place of peace and hope. And today, as we look at this world-famous peninsula, we ask if you know why it's called Kalaupapa. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites the Kauai community to a screening of Moana Nui Akea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members this Saturday at Kauai Community College's Performing Arts Center. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Dawson.
Thousands of university students return to the classroom today, adding to the traffic on the freeways. Hope your morning commute wasn't too painful. This morning, HBR's Kuve Hiraishi joins us to talk about enrollment numbers across the University of Hawaii system. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right, and I should say that the official enrollment numbers won't be in until the end of September, and that's just because of the late registry, there's folks who might drop out or drop classes, things like that. So the preliminary numbers that I pulled up online this morning show us close to last year's enrollment. Total across all 10 campuses, we've got about a little over or nearly 49,000 students. So it's a big drop from the peak back in at the end of the recession, so around 2011. We had about 10,000 more students on campus. So it's been gradually sort of declining. And we reached out to some of the officials at different campuses to figure out what they're doing and how they're dealing with these with this enrollment problem. So Artis Eschenberg's the chancellor over at Windward Community College. So of the community colleges on the list so far, looks like Windward will be seeing a slight boost in enrollment. And she talks about how she's sort of dealt with figuring out how to, change programming or cater to this change in enrollment.
Whenever there's a decrease in enrollment, as colleges, we worry and think about how that impacts us and what we're able to offer and how we're able to offer it. It's scary, right? Because your enrollment goes up and down, and enrollment is tuition dollars. But I think rather than focusing on being afraid of what's happening or worrying about how economy drives enrollment, we've really focused on how do we best serve our students in our community.
That's right. So she's a bit of an optimist, I'd say, in these conversations, but really long-term vision when it comes to being prepared for whoever is going to come onto her community college campus and want to take a class. So catering to adult learners, they boosted their online classes, course offerings, so that folks can do classes when they get home at the end of their 9-to-5. They've also kind of invested in early college programs that allow them to get into high schools and expose students to college work and to the college itself, just knowing that there's Windward Community College around the corner, for that to be an opportunity for them once they start considering what they're going to do after high school. So those two sort of best practices, at least for that community college, has been a big point of hope for them. For community colleges, a lot of the students who end up going to these colleges are usually folks who kind of are on that cusp of working, but they're thinking, okay, maybe I'm not going to get a good job right now. That was, you know, one of the big problems, or one of the big boosts towards the end of the recession was that the economy was bad, so it's hard to find jobs, so why not go back to school and start with community college? So there was a boost in enrollment across all campuses at the end of that. For Judy Oliveira, Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs over at UH West Oahu, the idea of this new school, so they moved to the Kapolei campus, let's see, 2012, so right after that recession, but they've actually been seeing some pretty consistent growth in their student body, mainly because, you know, they're
it's a beautiful campus.
Exactly. And there's a lot of students out on the west side who maybe don't need to then make the trek all the way up to UH Manoa and sit in that traffic that you were talking about earlier. So there's a lot of plus points in terms of UH West Oahu kind of having this captive audience of students. But the preliminary numbers so far see a slight reduction or decline in enrollment from last year. So this would be the first time since they moved to the Kapolei campus where they've seen less students, I guess, or fewer students in the classrooms. But Judy Oliveira had a very interesting, perspective on why students are choosing not to go to college. So here's what she had to say.
They feel they need to be working, of course, you know, to live in Hawaii. That actually competes with them deciding, am I going to go to work and pay my bills and put food on my table for my family, or am I going to go to college? And while college is a sacrifice, you know, for 4 years, it is hard. We understand that. That's why we do everything we possibly can at UH West Oahu to make sure that we address barriers such as financial aid, making sure that courses are offered during the times that they need, and then also just making sure that they understand that we're there for them throughout this time.
That's right. So the UH West Oahu campus has about a little over 3,000 students, same as UH Hilo, our four-year universities, but UH Manoa, 17,000 as of last year. And I think when we're talking about numbers, sort of record-breaking numbers last year for UH Manoa, they did have the largest incoming freshman class in fall of 2018. And they also had, I believe, a record number of applications in earlier this calendar year, about 19,000 applications coming in for folks wanting to go to UH Manoa. So there was some, I guess, some bright point for UH Manoa, but still the continuing sort of decline from that peak. And this is something that's being seen on college campuses and universities across the nation since the end of the recession, is just this continuing decline in college and folks pursuing college at this time. Got to speak to Ryan Yamaguchi. He is the assistant director of admissions at UH Manoa. He's been there for 19 years, so it was interesting to hear his perspective on how things have changed throughout this recession, and how he says a lot of when he goes out or when anybody from his staff goes out to recruit students, it's a huge change from when he started there. There's a lot more. They're going in really young, so we're looking for students as early as sixth grade in some instances are being recruited or just exposed to UH as an option, so that hopefully throughout their middle school and also in high school, there'll be touch opportunities.
Right, plant a seed.
Exactly. And it's earlier, and it's also very competitive because a lot of the mainland institutions who are also seeing a decline in enrollment are looking for our Hawaii students because they're good academically, but also to sort of diversify the campus in some instances. But here's Ryan talking about sort of some of the new techniques that they've been putting up at UH Manoa.
True. Many tools in the toolbox, expanding into the world of social media, digital media itself. It helps to get us to into the living rooms and to reach into reach to students in ways that we couldn't do in the past by phone or by just regular snail mail.
That's right. And as folks might have heard that, yes, KCC, Kapi'olani Community College, one of the larger community colleges, has been hit with a $2.1 million budget deficit at this point. And it is in large part because of enrollment or tuition and fees that they would usually collect from a decline in enrollment. And so they will be making the tough decision of cutting some courses and also some temporary student jobs. And I should say that KCC's dependence on tuition and fees, I believe it's close to 50% of their budget comes from tuition and fees. On the UH system system-wide budget, it's more like 14. So it's, you know, it's an idea of how much you've diversified your, I guess, your revenue streams when it comes to that as well.
It'd be interesting to see with the new Culinary Institute, you know, how that's, if it's
maybe
attracted students or not.
Right. And they've got, I think, a really good EMT program as well. But yes, it's they still have these very strong programs, and it's sometimes hard to get that one program's tuition and fees to float the rest. But we will see. I think there's a lot of support from the other institutions in the system to figure out how we can best help KCC its students.
All right. Well, thanks so much. That was Kuvei Hirishi taking a closer look at the lower enrollment on some campuses this fall following record numbers last year.
Join us Saturday, August 31st in HPR's Atherton Studio. It's shakuhachi music like you've never heard before. Christopher Blaisdell and Sasha Bogdanovich push the boundaries of the bamboo flute and pan drum in a performance that's both classically rooted and avant-garde. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Amoresco.
It seems like every time we turn around, there's another fire that crews are battling. That's the subject of our reality chat with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Nathan Eagle joins us from their Kaimuki studios. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
Hey, I really like the banner that you have with your story with all that smoke. It's very eye-popping.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Corey Lum shot that last month over on Maui.
So tell us about this, the wildfire trend.
Well, it's not looking good. I talked to a number of experts, and they all seem to think it's just going to get worse, and for a couple reasons. One is climate change. You know, we're getting these wetter winters and drier summers. That's growing a whole bunch of fuel, and then it's drying it all out. And the other half of the equation is we have a lot of fields that are just have been laying fallow, sugar and pineapple plantations that are no longer in production. And that just has created this nice little recipe for a ton of brush fires.
I recall when the last sugar mill shut down on Maui, they talked about that very fact, that it was going to be a challenge with so many fields. Basically, it's just fuel for fire.
Absolutely. You know, I headed over to Maui this past weekend to get some shots and talk to some of the residents there about what this situation has meant for them. And the very first day I'm there, just south of Pa'ia, there's a huge brush fire just raging.
Yes, your story has a lot of nice aerials kind of showing the areas that have just been burned.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's just literally on all the islands, too, there's just no shortage of these, you know, large-scale farms that are no longer in production. And with that, you know, the experts have said, you know, because of that, all of that land is been taken over by these non-native grasses and shrubs that, you know, like the guinea grass grows 6 inches a day. You know, they just have outcompeted all the native species as well. And it's just a ton of fuel and not a lot of land management going on to keep these fires away.
And as far as them starting, I mean, so you've got a lot of dry grass and maybe careless people out there starting the fires.
That's the thing. Unlike some of these other effects of climate change that sometimes people feel a little hopeless about, you know, like sea level rise, you know, it's hard to really put the brakes on that, at least individually. But this, we are starting almost every single fire in the Hawaiian Islands, because there's just not a lot of lightning to spark things. A little bit on the Big Island, but not really in any of the other islands. And so whether intentionally or not, we are starting all these fires, so that's obviously something we can do something about.
And it is sad when you think that there may be people out there that are intentionally starting these fires, because they can be deadly.
They absolutely can. And nowhere are we seeing that more than on the west side of Oahu. The Waianae Valley has more ignitions, as the experts call it, than any place else in Hawaii, and really more than anywhere else in the country. And a lot of those are arsons. Some of it's also just vehicles and things like that that are left out. You know, a spark happens, and next thing you know, you've got a big fire going. But I think was it just March? We had video from Senator Shimabukuro, who captured like this guy in a standoff with police, who had allegedly just set up several fires. I think he was holding a blowtorch at the time. So we need to do more for that. And fortunately, there's some community groups out there that are working on that.
I recall one summer, I think we had so many brush fires that we used to hate listening to the scanners, because, you hear the call. And I remember being out there with a fire engine, and we actually watched the flames leap over this road, and we were in danger of being surrounded by fire. We just got out quick because it was not a safe situation.
It's really not. I mean, you know, just standing Friday on the other side of Hana Highway, you know, we could feel the heat like very intensely, and it had yet to cross over, and they fortunately kept it from crossing over, as I understand. But it's super dangerous, and not just for the health of people and things like that, but there are these long term effects that professors like Camila Mora have been looking into and studying, for mental health issues and disease, and, you know, the degradation of the air quality, and it's harmed coral reefs. You know, it's threatening our freshwater supplies. There's just this long list of effects of wildfires that makes it a very serious issue.
I recall covering those fires, and the ash that's produced is just amazing, because the ones in Makaha, they would go over to the North Shore or vice versa, you know, and then, you know, your cars are just blanketed with this gray ash. It's not very good to be breathing that stuff in.
Nope, not good to be breathing it in. It snarls traffic. It's canceling flights at times. It's a big problem.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, as it washes down into the ocean, it affects all the marine life.
Yeah, exactly. That's a point William Isla was emphasizing when I talked to him. He's like, yeah, there are the fires, you know, deep into the valleys and even up in the mountains. But he's like, we can't lose track of the fact and the cost, as he put it, that's happening down in our reefs when it then rains and washes all this loose soil down into the ocean.
And it's almost really like a double insult, because, you know, the scientists are predicting more coral bleaching because of the warm water. And then you have all this ash kind of being deposited, smothering the reef. So not a good situation as we go into the hottest months of the year.
Not at all. Yeah, there's a lot of that climate double whammies, as Josh Sambo was putting it. You know, we had fires just recently where it started because of a lot of the effects of climate change, and then you have the remnants of tropical storms literally fanning the flames of it.
Scary times that we live in.
Indeed.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
You bet.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read his stories online, visit civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HBR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and things we might be able to look for in our dark skies. As usual, we've got the services of Christopher Phillips to thank for our report this week, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Chris, what do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southern sky after sunset. The moon this week is passing through its new moon phase, and so sky brightness will be perfect for stargazing.
And this week, I understand you've got something about moons on the outer edge of the solar system?
Yeah, so here on Stargazer, we've often considered the promise that the moons of the outer solar system hold, especially the icy bodies like Europa, Enceladus, and Titan. These moons are considered to possess enormous potential when it comes to the possibility of life. But so far, no spacecraft has had sufficient time or instruments to study them in required detail. However, that's all set to change because NASA's Europa Clipper mission has been greenlit to enter its final stages of development before launch in 2023.
Oh, that's great news. What will the mission consist of?
So the Europa Clipper will investigate in meticulous detail the moon Europa. The main goal of this mission will be to determine whether or not Europa really is capable of supporting conditions that may permit the existence of life.
And what's involved? Do they have a lander, or is that place just a bit too hostile for something like that?
No, this is purely an orbital reconnaissance of Europa. We still know very little about conditions on the surface, let alone under the thick sheet of ice that covers the moon. So sending a lander on a potential suicide mission right now is not really the best use of resources.
And how about identifying potential future landing sites?
And that's one of the goals, yeah. But that's a secondary goal to determining the nature of Europa's subsurface ocean, which is where we're expected to find life if there is any, of course.
Another interesting report. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Kalaupapa. Many of us have heard of it. Maybe you've even had a chance to visit. It is quite a physical feat to get to this isolated peninsula on the north coast of Molokai, effectively cut off from the rest of the island by the spectacular 2,000-foot-high cliff. You're probably well aware of the leper colony started there in 1865 and how it was transformed by Father Damien's ministry starting in 1873. But long before it gained its modern history, ancient Hawaiians farmed it and lived in Kalaupapa's four ahupua'a. Its broad, smooth, and gently sloping plain was ideal for agriculture, and its name is a practical reflection of its physical shape. Those early Hawaiians who first gazed down from the pali thought it resembled a broad, flat leaf, and so they named it Kalaupapa, the flat leaf. No winners today on that one. We did stump you. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We haven't heard a lot about measles in the last few weeks, but it has not dropped off the radar of public health officials. We recently sat down with Dr. Sarah Park. She's a state epidemiologist, a pediatrician, and she shares that being a new mom has given her additional insight into fears about whether or not to vaccinate. Across the country, there have been more than 1,000 measles cases, an eye-opener, when it was back in the year 2000 that the U.S. was declared measles-free. Two steps forward and how many steps back? Well, Dr. Park reflects on what's happening with this measles outbreak, not just in the U.S., but across the Pacific as well.
It's calming down a little bit on the mainland, but it is still pretty active in some of these other jurisdictions. And people are saying, have you joined the measles party yet? And Hawaii definitely does not want to join the measles party. Unfortunately, we know that Alaska, our northern neighbor, has joined the measles party. About a month ago, they had some cases up there. And so we've been watching that very closely. California certainly has had cases. And then internationally, of course, unfortunately, we're still seeing a lot of measles in the Philippines, and New Zealand is having a big outbreak, an ongoing outbreak centered around Auckland, and some of the other Pacific areas. So we're really in Japan, also having an outbreak or has had one. And so we're very cognizant of what's going on around us and trying to with your help, folks like you, getting the word out about making sure that our community is protected and, you know, we all do get vaccinated, and protecting, you know, the young infants who can't, you know, get vaccinated because of their age, immunocompromised, who, you know, because of their medical treatments or their just naturally some issue with their immune system are unprotected, you know, and therefore vulnerable. Our elderly who, for whatever reason, maybe, you know, from not necessarily from measles, but from other things maybe. And so it's really just trying to make sure our community is strong. And protecting everyone around us, including our own selves.
No, at the beginning of the year, I was in Seattle, and it was when they were experiencing that outbreak, and they were declaring, like, emergencies in different counties.
Right.
Here it is, August, school started. We've seen some very enlightening numbers about what schools might be at risk because they have a larger population of students that have not been vaccinated, whose parents have opted out for religious reasons. Or there was some discussion about how do we deal with that going forward. So what's the plan for the school year since we have started already?
Yeah, well, so it's the same as always in that we're trying to get the message out to parents, to providers, to encourage vaccinations, ensure that our community understands why it's so important to protect our kids as well as our community. You know, trying to help get more information out there for those who might be on the fence. And really, I would encourage those who are on the fence to take a look at information that's available on our website. And if not on our website, just to also talk to your healthcare provider, to whether it's a physician, nurse practitioner, and ask them about, you know, the vaccines and have that conversation. It's really important to have that conversation. And you're also welcome to call our immunization program and ask for information. And we have any number of staff who would be willing and helpful in helping to understand some of the diseases that we're protecting against and the vaccines as well.
So what does the department have planned just for education in the next couple of months?
Well, we're starting to gear up in that we're working on some posters, you know, some of those like what they call infographic posters, so that it's easy to sort of read those posters and understand the information, so that regardless of language and such, especially cognizant of in here in Hawaii, we have so many different cultures. And so trying to work on some of these infographic type posters around the vaccine preventable diseases, making them available to healthcare providers so they can post them and to other areas, potentially schools as well, so that, you know, we can help to educate our community to get that information out there, because we are hearing from our community, some parts of our community, that part of why they are on the fence is because they don't feel like they have access to the information. And so we're trying to make sure that information is available.
And that's probably the biggest challenge if folks don't trust what's out there.
You know, trust is an earned thing. And again, I think, you know, it starts with some people you in the community, every one of us in our community, we have people we trust, and hopefully you trust your healthcare provider, and that is a good source to start with. You know, physicians go through a lot of training, as do nurse practitioners. I mean, and they're a good source to start with. And then you also want to go to reputable sources, sources that are science-based. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization. Our website is about trying to get that information out there and trying to help make other information from reputable sources accessible. So from CDC, we know that sometimes some of these other sort of organizations, their websites might be a little bit hard to navigate. So we're trying to help provide those direct links to areas. And again, it's also based on feedback from what we hear. So encouraging our community to reach out to us to let us know what else could we be doing to help you.
You know, you're a new mom, and you know, my kids are grown now. But I remember there was a time when my daughter, I think, got strep throat, and I didn't know it was strep throat. I didn't think it was, you know, I just thought it was a bad sore throat. And I'm like, oh, you'll be fine. And then she had strep throat. And I just did a story recently about somebody who had to get a kidney transplant, and she said she developed a condition because she had strep throat and there was an autoimmune thing going on, and she was, you know, in her 20s. And so it really just kind of made me kind of gulp, thinking, gosh, you know, you try and do the right thing with your child, and but sometimes you don't know. And
No, I totally get it. I mean, especially as a different perspective now as a parent, but as a pediatrician, I mean, for years working with parents and such, and, you know, I totally understand and totally emphasize that, you know, I mean, here I am with my own son you know, I watch everything that goes in his mouth, you know what I mean? So I totally understand that. And that's why, as from that perspective, and as a pediatrician, I'm here to tell you, vaccines are really important. We have years and years of data, years and years of experience now to show all the benefits that we've, as a community, not just this community here in Hawaii, but in the United States and globally, have reaped from vaccinations. It's because of those successes that we aren't seeing these diseases on the large scale anymore. Unfortunately, what's happening is that people are questioning the benefits of those vaccines, and we're starting to see sort of these bigger and bigger pockets that are opening up of vulnerable areas in our community, people who are no longer immune to these diseases. And that's the concern for me as a parent, as a physician, and as a public health official, in that, you know, our community is becoming more and more vulnerable because of this. And so it is about, how do we shore up our defenses now at this point, and how do we protect our community and help people understand why it is so important that we maintain the level of immunization that we've had in the past uniformly throughout the state. And so it's not easy. I can empathize as to why parents are, you know, might be a little leery. They're not sure. They hear different things and such. But I would say, look to the science. The science is there. The data is there in well-performed and conducted studies. I don't know what more I can say at this point, you know, except as mom, I really feel strongly as well about the need for vaccination.
So vaccinations for measles, there's also the big flu push, right, mm-hmm. to get vaccinated for that as well.
Right. I mean, and I think also people have commented, oh, flu vaccine isn't great. You know, it doesn't, what it's going to do. I understand that too. And it's important to remember that not all vaccines are equal, and that not all vaccines are as effective as the next vaccine. You know, we know, for example, hepatitis A vaccine is incredibly effective in that, you know, you get vaccinated, you're probably good. You're immune for life. Measles vaccine, or measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, also fairly good in terms of measles protection. And then you have flu vaccine, which unfortunately is a hit or miss. And part of that is the challenge in terms of trying to, you know, we don't really have a universal flu vaccine, in that the flu vaccine has to be reformulated every year and against specific strains. One day, that's the dream of a lot of the scientists and researchers at like NIH, National Institutes of Health, and other places, where one day we will have a universal vaccine where you just have to get it once and we're good. We're good against all flus. But, you know, it reflects the complexity of the pathogens that we're trying to protect against. Consider this too. You know, I hear a lot of people comment about, oh my God. And I know, as a parent going, taking my son to the, you know, doctor's appointments for the vaccinations, seems like a lot of shots, right? But when you think about it from the perspective of the fact that there are thousands of pathogens out there, and probably more that we haven't discovered yet, frankly, or identified yet, you know, and we really have, when you compare the number of vaccines against that, is really barely even a drop in the bucket, so to speak, that we're protecting our kids against. And what we've basically done is identify the ones that have caused the most horrendous, most numerous, most, you know, the biggest burden of disease, essentially, and the biggest cost to society and our culture, our communities, and are trying to protect against those. Unfortunately, we don't have vaccines against some other things like strep throat. And there are scientists who are working to try to develop vaccines against some of these other pathogens. But for now, we have these handful, and vaccine is still the method of prevention. I will say as one last thing, though, and that is that don't forget to wash your hands, because that's still important. Just because you have the vaccine does not preclude you from remembering to wash your hands, or when you do get sick from whatever else is out there, to not share your germs. Remember to not share your germs with the rest of the community.
That was state epidemiologist Sarah Park, a pediatrician and a new mom, talking about the measles and flu vaccinations as students are back in school this month. We have to go, but up tomorrow, we open up our phone lines as we talk to School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto. Got a burning question to ask? Now's your chance. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talk back line, leave your comments, or leave your questions. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.